Magnetic field. How's everyone feeling? Are you ready for some crazy fast retro gaming? So, I apologize for my master's thesis style title. You can just imagine there's a colon between there. But who's come across speedrunning before? And who's come across tool-assisted speedrunning? That's a good number of you. So for everyone else, here's a normal speedrun. You'll have to bear with me because I can't see the video on this screen, but that's my laptop's problem. Anyway, so this is the world record for Mario, completed by a person. It's at Speed Demos Archive. This is the first level. I'm not going to show you the whole game. But you can see he's got Yoshi, and now he's powering through the level as quickly as possible, trying to avoid slowing down by hitting a ramp at any point. And it's smooth, it's fast, and we finish the level. But here's the same level done as a tool-assisted speedrun. So it's very similar in lots of ways. We get the Yoshi. But once we get the Yoshi, there's loads more activity happening. We're jumping around everywhere, we pick up a shell, we're going to spit it out, pick it up. I don't care. I might be trying to do this quickly, but I'm also going to have fun along the way. And we get to the end of the level, and it just finishes. We're not going to wait for the goalposts. I'm going to talk more about what exactly just happened in a minute, but I'm going to start by describing what a tool-assisted speedrun is. It's played in an emulator. It uses all the things that make life easier. So you can use save states, you can use slowdown, you can use frame advance. So if you need to get something lined up frame perfectly, you can give it a go. If it doesn't work, then you can try it again. The movie files that these emulators record, they don't record the screen, the output. What they do is they record the input. So if you've got a D-pad like this, it's got 8 buttons. You can imagine what we're doing is creating a piano roll of on each frame, and you know, most American games have 60 frames a second, European games have 50 frames a second. We record which buttons were pressed on that frame. So this little screen on the left here is showing 30 frames, so half a second's worth of input, and so there's nothing happening for a while, and then we rapidly alternate right and left on the D-pad, and then we start pressing A and B together, and then we let go of A, but B carries on. And that's the recording. And if you play the same set of inputs back to a game, from starting from the same power-on state, then the game will behave in the same way. All the monsters will do the same things. All the environment will happen the same way. And you can't just do this in any normal emulator. It needs to be adjusted with a feature called re-recording. So it's not just about recording your activity, but also if you make a mistake, you can go back to a save state and start recording again from that point. For those of you who are programmers, you might have used editors with undo tree. You can rewind and try something else, and then rewind and try. And this is the heart of what tool-assisted speedruns are about. It's about trying to get the best possible thing. You can use slowdown and frame advance. You can use memory watch. So there's loads of stuff happening in the game's memory at any time that's maybe not visible on the screen. But if you can read it into the and take advantage of it, then there's no trouble with that. And so the way I would express it is that regular speedruns are about human achievement. They're about skill. They're about how fast can a person complete this game. Whereas a tool-assisted speedrun is about theoretical limits. How fast can this game be beaten if there's a perfect player? So we want behavior that's pixel perfect and frame perfect. So I'm just going to show you a bunch of crazy stuff that happens in tool-assisted speedruns. There's not a great narrative running through these talks. It's just a bunch of videos I thought were cool. So this section I called Exploiting Bugs. So here's collision detection. Now, does anyone remember this level from Super Mario Brothers? So what you might remember from this level is that it's possible to run across, get up on top of the ceiling at the top. It looks like there's a solid ceiling, but you can break through it and get to the end of the level up that lift. But with a tool-assisted speedrun, you can exploit the collision detection and just go straight through the wall, and that's even faster, it turns out. Other things you can do, if dying and you're using an extra life advances your cause, then great, do that. There's loads of games where you can actually go faster by deliberately dying at a point. But I think this one is my favorite. It's Jumpman Jr. for the ColecoVision. Who remembers the ColecoVision? It's a really early 80s console. So you've got to collect all of these brown circles to win the level. And you've got to sort of weave in and out, and it takes a while. But on the other side, we can just die and fall down and collect the things on the way down. And we still win the level. The other thing about that is when you die, you're bouncing around in a really random way. And it's important that when you bounce around, that you do bounce and collect all of the items. So this is also an example of a technique called luck manipulation, which I'll talk about later. Another technique that's used is pressing left and right at the same time, or up and down at the same time. Now this is a Nintendo controller. That's a D-pad. It's not easy to press left and right at the same time because it's kind of rocker switch, but it is possible. And if it's possible, then it's fair game. Lots of game developers didn't expect people to do it. Here's Donkey Kong. I apologize for the lack of sound on this. We just press up and down there. And we're through. Here's a more modern thing. This is from the Nintendo 64. Super Mario 64. Super Mario 64 was the first 3D Mario. It was the precursor to Super Mario Sunshine and Super Mario Galaxy. It allowed you to do lots of things that you couldn't do before. So there were a lot more buttons on the controller, so there were lots of different kinds of jump. There were combos. And the developers knew that maybe if you combined these with jumping off a slope, you might be able to go really fast. And they wanted to stop you doing that too badly. So they put a cap on your speed, but it only applies to your forward movement. And so this is Bowser in the Dark World, one of the levels. I'm going to show you this video twice because it's overproofing. Here, we jump backwards loads of times, and suddenly we've done the level. I'll show that one to you again in case you missed it. It's when you get to the rising platform, we do lots of backward plonk jumps at the same time. And suddenly... I'd like to see some of you try that in the retro gaming tent later. This is a great one. This is Kid Chameleon from the Sega Mega Drive. Anyone played this game? This is it's a fascinating, slightly experimental, side-scrolling platform game. It has a weird oversight in that after pressing any direction key, it takes a frame for the game to realize that you're in midair and you should start falling. If during that frame you press another direction key, it'll take another frame for the game to realize you should start falling. So if you just keep alternating two keys, you can never start falling. And so you can get things like in this level. So that was quite quick, I'll show you again. So this bit here, just hover over that laser. And that trick is quite valuable and useful sometimes throughout the speedrun. So tool-assisted speedruns form a community. And there's lots of ways, and although it's about finding that theoretical minimum, how fast can you do this game, you never know if you've hit it. And what's interesting is seeing a game iterate from one version to the next version and to see what new tricks have been discovered that allow you to go faster than the previous record. I'm going to show two improvements. One really big and obvious, and one really small and incremental, but they both have a relationship in a way. So this is from Super Metroid. This is the first boss in Super Metroid. You go into this room and you pick up the bombs, and then the door closes behind you. So that door on the left is open, and it closes behind you, and then this thing where it gave you the bombs turns out to come to life. You gotta wait for it to stand up, and then you gotta boss fight. And that's, you know, a reasonable time for that boss fight. Once the boss dies, the door opens again. That was from 2007 by a speedrunner called Hero of the Day. The very next year, the same runner submitted another entry to replace it, to supersede it. This was his new strategy. Turns out you can actually get out in time, and even future runs have gone even faster, and it's improved even on that. But I think that was a big moment in Super Metroid speedrunning. Now I'm going to show. This video shows 10 of the last Super Mario World speedruns, all shown at the same time, so to compare how things have improved over the years. So. This is the level where you get the cape for the first time, the feather. And you can see it doesn't take long before some of these ghosts start lagging behind. So it's not just about big ticket things that speed you up. It's also just very gradual pulling ahead throughout the whole game. So how are they able to move faster than they were able to move before? Well, it turns out you'd think the fastest way to move in Mario is to hold the run button and hold the right button. And it turns out that's not the case. So the early speedruns would try that. And of course, that's what real-time speedrunners do as well. But what happens is Mario is built, it's actually got an engine that understands a finer grain of movement than pixels, called subpixels. So each pixel is divided into 16 subpixels, and speed is measured in subpixels. And when you hold run and right, your speed on each of 5 frames goes around this cycle. So you've got 48 frames, 48 subpixels per frame, then 47, then 48, then 47, then 49. And the average of those 5 is 47.8. It turns out that if you let go of the run button and the right button in midair, there's no friction, so you'll just stay at the speed where you let go. And if you let go on that 49 frame, you can stay at 49. And even when you land and jump, if you jump exactly on the frame you land, you can stay at 49, and so you can be faster all the way through to the end of the level. You can be 49 frames a second, which is faster than. So you're getting 1.2 subpixels per frame ahead of someone who's just holding the run button. There is a problem with that, which is because you're not holding the run button, the game doesn't think you're running, even though you're moving really fast. And so if you need something where the game needs you to be running, like to take off with the cape, you can't take off unless you're running, or to jump high, you don't get the run bonus unless the game thinks you're running, then you need to somehow preserve the run counter while at the same time exploiting the movement. And in order to solve this problem, a speedrunner at some point discovered this 8/5 strategy, where you let go for 8 frames at 49, so you get the speed bonus, and then you hold right and run for 5 frames. And then that goes through this cycle of 49, 48, 47, 46, 47. And the average over that 13-frame cycle is 48.38 and so on frames per subpixels per frame. So you're gaining 0.6 subpixels per frame over someone who's just holding right. And then later on, someone else comes along and says, well, actually, that's good, but this is better. It's 6/5. because your speed doesn't decay as much, even though it's a shorter cycle, so you get less 49 frames, you also don't get that 46 frame. And so that's faster, again, by a 0.06 subpixel. So there's every frame, and that does add up, and if it means you complete a whole level one frame faster, that's a new record. And some aggressively speedrun games like Mario World or Mario Brothers have got to the point where if you can beat it by one frame, then great. There's that's how closely beaten these games are at this stage. But if you think about it, all of this sort of tightly manipulating and sweating the small stuff is what allows you to then go on and do these big things of. Because this is only possible because of a whole bunch of stuff that allows you to go that bit faster than you normally can in Metroid. Which is why that's actually not possible to do in real time. I don't know why I put this slide in, but so this next game I want to talk about. This is a game called Hyper Princess Peach. It's actually a relatively recent game. It's a Windows independent game by a guy called Daniel Remar. He's made a number of independent games. And this is kind of like a top-down shoot 'em up in the spirit of Smash TV or that sort of thing. And this game has a number of difficulty levels, like a lot of games do. But it has a joke difficulty level that's way harder than any of the others. There's, you know, a large integer number times the number of enemies on the previous skill level, and there are no power-ups, and there are no health refills, and there are no ammo refills. So you have to get through the whole game with what you start with. And so mostly that means you can only use the brick, which is the lowest weapon that you get infinite ammo for, and the pile driver, which is a special move that you've always got access to. And the thing about this joke skill level, it's called Really Joel's Mum's Difficulty due to some sort of in-joke about his friend Really Joel, who said his mum could beat that hardest level on with two hands tied behind her back. And there's a running joke throughout the whole of Daniel Remar's set of games about Really Joel's mum and Really Joel's dad. And but when he created this joke hard difficulty level, the game designer didn't actually know if it was possible to beat. And so doing a tool-assisted speedrun of this skill level is brilliant because you're doing something that no one knew if it was possible or not. And when you look at this, you see a number of bullets flying through the air. You can see why they didn't think it might be possible. And so each pile driver, you're safe in the air, but as soon as you land, you have to land somewhere that doesn't have a bullet on it before you take off again. I don't have a segue for this. So luck manipulation. I mentioned luck manipulation earlier on in the death abuse game, Jumpman Jr., where we had to fall down, but we had to randomly bounce in order to collect all of the items. So this is another mainstay of tool-assisted speedrunning, which is that if you don't get the outcome you need from some random event, then go back to a save state and try and re-record until you do get the right outcome you need. And you know, there's loads of things in games that depend on random chance, like you might get a random amount of damage from an enemy, so you want to minimize that, or you might give a random amount of damage to an enemy, so that you might want to maximize that. Items drop from enemies, they either appear or they don't, and they're either good or they're not so good. It's important to say here that games are random, but they're deterministic. So if you input the same buttons in the same order, the game has to act in the same way. So if you don't like the random results that you got, you go back to a save state and try something different and see if you get a different result. And so tool-assisted speedruns should seem to be unusually lucky. And this is an example from a game most of us would know is Tetris. This is Tetris for the NES with that wonderful music. This is mode B, where you get a load of blocks that start on the screen already, and you have to clear them. But of course, as you clear them, it is a game of skill to a certain extent, but also, when you have that moment, you need the long thin one, then no other piece will do, and you have to manipulate the right piece to arrive at the right moment to get through the level as quickly as possible. And especially when we get near the end of the stage, there'll be a point where you need the long thin one, and hey presto, the long thin one appears. So, to talk in more detail about how this works, within each game there'll be a thing called a pseudo-random number generator, a PRNG. And effectively what that does is it generates an infinite list of numbers in a deterministic way. And these numbers have good statistical properties for setting up random events. Here's an example list of numbers that you might get out of a random number generator. And when the game needs to make a random choice, say what block are you going to get in Tetris, or what item is this monster going to drop, it draws a number from that sequence and consumes that number. So in this case, the next number is 21271. It uses this number to make a decision. Let's say there's a 50-50 chance of a monster dropping an item. So it takes that number and it says, is this number even? Because that's something that has a 50% chance of being right. And if it is even, the monster drops the number. And if it's not even, then the monster doesn't drop the item. And in this case, it's not even, so you don't get a drop. If the currently available number, the next number from the sequence, isn't going to do what you want, what you can do is you can do something to waste that number on something else. One game I know, there's sort of lots of things that don't really affect the outcome that are random as well. One game I know, every time you take a sword swipe, you have a chance of grunting. And that consumes a number from the random number generator. But it's a purely cosmetic thing. So you could just swipe your sword twice, and you'll grunt twice. You may or may not grunt. You'll use the number to decide that. And then we get onto the next number, 21154, and that is even. And so that's great. That will get us the drop that we need. Here's an extreme case of King's Bounty for the Mega Drive, of luck manipulation. I think I mentioned in the talk blurb that there's a game completed in 0.3 seconds, roughly. That's this one. So King's Bounty, for those of you who have never played it, it's... I feel like I need to introduce it because it's over so quickly that you won't know what's happened. It's an RPG. It's essentially one big fetch quest. The king has lost his scepter. There's some baddies who you need to go and rough up until they give you clues to where in the world it might be. It's buried underground somewhere. But at the start of the game, where exactly in the world the scepter is randomly assigned. And so what if you kept trying to start the game over and over again in order to get the scepter to generate under the starting position? So this is the title screen. That's us searching, that's us winning. That's the game over. And what I really like is this win screen where the king looks really happy with you. There's all this blurb, but at the bottom it says, I'm giving you this medal commemorating your final score of 0. Congratulations for being really efficient. Now, we're going to get into something I've actually done now, which is this Castlevania Aria of Sorrow, All Souls. Now, I don't have the patience that it takes to actually make a speed run, but it turns out I do have enough patience to try and do some luck manipulation. This was a game for the Game Boy Advance. I don't know how many of you have played it. There's a few nodding heads, a few hands up, great. It has a mechanic in it where every time you kill a monster, there's lots of things it might drop. But one of those things is a soul. And each soul that you get from a type of monster gives you a new special power. But if you get all of the souls possible in the game, then you get the best ending. And so this is one of the categories, is you have to go around and get all of the souls before finishing the game. as a real-time attack category, this would be really frustrating because some of these souls have a chance of less than 0.5% of dropping. So all you can do in a real-time speed run is go into a room, kill the monster, it didn't drop it, go out, go in, the monster's back, kill the monster, it didn't drop it, and just keep trying again and again and again, and that's not fun. But in a tool-assisted speed run, you can go back to a save state and try again, and so manipulate the random number generator throughout the whole run to make sure that we do get the souls that we need. And so here's an example. So that thing's a soul, the thing that flew through the air. We didn't get one from the Triton. We're going to get this poison worm one. Got another. We're going to skip that Triton soul. Oh no, we got it. So that's three souls just in one room. There's 120 in the game. We come down to this room. And there's three more we need as we pass through here. One, two, three. And that sort of thing just doesn't happen in real-time play. But it's also quite difficult to achieve in tool-assisted play because especially the way people used to do it was by brute force. Let's just try it. If it doesn't work, let's go back to a save state and maybe swing the sword a few times and try again. A better technique would be to actually analyze the drop algorithm. What happened? And that's the bit I did. So these emulators, as well as having memory watch and save state, you can also disassemble the game's code. And the Game Boy Advance, turns out, is running an ARM machine, so you can read the ARM disassembly. And ARM assembly is one of the, if you don't know assembly language, ARM's a nice one to start with, it turns out. You can even attach a debugger to your game as you're playing it. So you can put a watch on the bit in memory that is the random number generator to see what's reading the random number state at any point in time, and you can step through the processes. And I did this. It took me a long time, but eventually I found out when you kill a monster, this is what happens. And I'm not going to go through this whole slide, but it draws several random numbers at various points. It does various things with those. There's parameters, like there's an S parameter, which is a soul difficulty parameter. There's L, which is your luck as a stat in the game. There's J, which is an item difficulty parameter. And once you've got this algorithm, what you can do with it is you can put it into a Lua script. Do people know Lua? Who knows Lua? There's a few people. For those of you who don't, it's a bit like JavaScript, but nicer. Yeah, broadly agreement there. JavaScript is a language embedded in browsers. Lua seems to be the language that gets embedded in emulators. So regardless of the system you're working on, whether it's Game Boy or Super Nintendo or Mega Drive or whatever, it'll have a Lua scripting capability. And there'll be APIs to allow you to read memory. So you can read what the current random number generator seed is. You can simulate the death drop algorithm that was on the previous slide. And then you can simulate it not just against the current random number seed, but you can compute upcoming random numbers and see, is it going to be any better against them? And on top of that, you can draw on the screen as you're playing the game. And so this is the script that I wrote. So this is that corridor. Soma, the character, is fighting this Triton, and there's this overlay, and it tells you that this Triton has 367 hit points and 999 mana points. But then the next bit, in 12 random numbers time, if you kill it, it'll drop a big heart. In 14 random numbers time, if you kill it, it'll drop a little heart. In 21, it'll drop a common item. In 31, it'll drop a common item. And in 34, it'll drop a soul. So that's what this little display is trying to tell you. And it's that S that we're after. So I think for that reason, so this is taken from that speed run, this is why this Triton was skipped until we get to one that's got a more convenient random number that will drop the soul at a useful time. And you can play the whole game and this script with this script running in the background, and it will show every monster, these are all the things that you might get from the monster, and this is how many random numbers away you are. And so that's how the third version of the Aria of Solar All Souls Run was created, that video that I just showed you. Moving on to another thing. This is a more recent innovation into assisted speedrunning, is rather than actually complete the game the normal way that normal players do, they find ways to skip straight to the end. So we're back onto Mario. This is the same first level. We're gonna get Yoshi again. It's all looking quite similar to the previous runs. Keep going. And that's the end credits. And we've won. Shortest game of Mario ever. So, going back to the very start of the talk, where I showed you the tool-assisted speedrun of Mario, where we didn't get to the goalposts and yet the level ended, that's this glitch. So this is part one of what just happened in this video as well. So there's a glitch where you can swap two items, and it turns out it's a classic memory management problem. We free an object before we've actually cleared all references to it. So in this case, Mario can collect items like coins or mushrooms, and Yoshi, the little dinosaur that he rides, can eat items with his tongue. And if you're acrobatic enough, you can have Mario collect an item at the same time that Yoshi is eating it. So you have to be riding Yoshi, you press the eat button, and then you jump off Yoshi and he carries on eating, but you collect the item. And when Mario collects the item, the game goes, right, that item's done because Mario's collected it. But Yoshi is still trying to eat it. And so that item slot has been freed. And if an item spawns, it will spawn into that slot that Yoshi has got a reference to. And in that first speedrun I showed you, the item that just spawned was the gold tape. And so we used this glitch to swap the gold tape onto Yoshi's tongue and thus complete the level early. Did that make some kind of sense? Getting some nods, good. So I'm gonna push on through. In this one, where we warp to the credits, so this is the game end glitch. So another item, instead of the goalpost tape that we could swap onto Yoshi's tongue and get Yoshi to eat, is a Charging Chuck, which is this American football player. And that causes problems because Yoshi can't normally eat a Charging Chuck. The tongue just goes straight past him. And the game developers didn't anticipate this situation happening. They thought they'd ruled it out. So when you swap the Charging Chuck onto Yoshi's tongue by freeing up the item just as the chuck spawns, then it jumps to an area of memory called Open Bus. I'll be honest, I don't understand what happens. There's a sort of miracle that happens that people who really understand Super Nintendo internals would tell you. But at some point, having jumped to Open Bus, we end up executing the controller registers. This is the bit of memory that records what the buttons are pressed on each of the controllers, and all four controllers count. And so what's happening is the SNES, the Super Nintendo system, is executing the controller input, but interpreting it as instructions. And you have control over the controller registers, so you can program the Nintendo system through the controller. So what we do is we set the right combination of buttons that will be interpreted as jump to the bit of code that starts the end credits. So that's how we were able to complete Mario without having even played half a level. But once you can execute the controller inputs, why just jump straight to the end? You know, we can do loads more with this. We can execute arbitrary code. And so this is an earlier version of the Mario run that executes arbitrary code. It uses a different glitch, and I like the glitch more, even though it's slower, because Mario is doing loads of stuff that makes no sense at all. So we had to scroll the screen back and forth using the shoulder buttons. We're using a glitch there to duplicate the block and create about 10 Yoshis. And they're still there, even though the game's not showing them all. So later on, you'll see some of the Yoshis stop being invisible and suddenly appear. We keep going back and forth. Every time we hit one of these apple things, we eat it in a weird way. And then more item swap duplication glitches to get some extra lives. And all of this stuff is about getting the memory into a particular state to execute this glitch. So these are the extra Yoshis appearing and dying. And so once we come down this pipe, we're almost ready to execute the glitch that goes to arbitrary code. Ah, sod Mario, I want to play Pong now. So that's exactly what's just happened, is just reprogrammed the game into a different game. And this isn't the only arbitrary code execution video. This isn't the first one either. There's loads of them now. It's becoming a fast-growing category on the tool-assisted speedrunning community. But I think this is a particularly fun one. This is from 2 years ago. This was premiered at Awesome Games Done Quick 2014. So that's all I've got. I've got references to all of the things. I can share the slides somehow afterwards on Twitter. I am filling stuff. I hope you enjoyed that. And if you're interested in the tool-assisted speedrunning community, then this taskvideos.org is where most of them tend to hang out. And there's huge articles about all of those games and how broken they are. So thank you very much. I think we've got a bit of time for questions. We've got about 4 minutes.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering, when somebody does the new fastest level, how do they prove that they've done it? Is it the video? Do they give the set of commands they use to prove it?
So I'm going to scroll right back through. So this comes back to the way the videos are recorded. Because they're recorded as input sequences, you can verify that this genuinely completes the game by taking the input file and putting it into your own copy of the emulator and running it through and checking that it really does beat the game and that it really does beat the game faster. So, and this is another big thing of why we record input files and not videos of the game. The question was, can people follow up on someone else's input file? And the answer is yes. And in fact, they, in some senses, have to, because new records have to beat all existing records. So if your new Super Metroid thing doesn't skip the bomb boss, the bomb Terrizzo boss, then you're not going to be accepted.
There's one. Hi. When you're doing the Pong and Snake inputs, how many key presses is that at the point of the glitch?
It's a lot. On all four controllers, if you watch, there's some encodes where you can watch a button press display. And of course, there's 60 frames per second, and there's, 16-ish buttons per controller. So that's 16 bits per controller times 4 times 60. That's the amount of bits per second that you have to play with to program the game. So broadly what ends up happening is you get to a point where there's 2 or 3 seconds solid of random button mashing, as far as anyone can tell, that's actually reprogramming the game. And it depends what the payload is that you're trying to program in. There's a particularly elaborate one for Super Mario Bros. 3 that reprograms it to have a bunch of features from Super Metroid instead. So it gives you the speed boost power up, and it gives you loads of other stuff.
There's somebody looking very excited about that.
Right, How applicable are these techniques to more modern games? So, for example, the RNG thing. Do more modern games have a consistent, well-defined random number generator, or do they just read from DevRandom and get actually random numbers?
That's a really interesting question. I think broadly, well-written games are still deterministic. I think one of the reasons classic games rather than more modern games tend to be speedrun like this is just because it's easier to emulate older consoles because they're simpler. But in principle, more modern games can be beaten in the same way. But going back to even old games, there's a game called Action 52, or 52 games. It was a bootleg thing for the Nintendo Entertainment System, and that was written in such a way that it did read from uninitialized RAM, and depending on how the console started, it actually was non-deterministic. But that tends to be badly programmed games that behave in that way.
Yeah. Hello. I was wondering, all the games you've seen are console games. What about arcade games? Is this, as far as I can understand, this is all tied to the ability of APIs in the emulators. So what's the state in the arcade game?
So arcade games are also, there are arcade game tool-assisted speedruns as well. I don't know a lot about the technical details of them, I'm afraid, but they do exist and are published on the same site on TAS videos. I think that's all we've got time for the moment, but if you've got any more questions, I'll be hanging around, maybe outside on this side, and I might be in the retro gaming tent later on. But thanks, you've been a great audience.